Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
is the Global Mail a new model for journalism?
Fairfax's big data dump.
ACP up for grabs.
Revenge is sweet for Seven.
With us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Monica Attard, managing editor of the Global Mail.
Good morning.
And Martin Lane, publishing director of Mumbrella.
Good morning.
Now, Monica, welcome to the podcast. You've just launched the Global Mail.
Yeah.
It's probably in that position where some of our listeners will already be aware of it and some won't.
Yeah.
So it's probably maybe just first of all explain a little bit about the site itself.
Well, for those who aren't aware of it as yet, www.theglobalmail.org, get my little plug in there. It is a philanthropically funded, not-for-profit, public interest journalism website. We publish text, largely long form, text, video, audio. We're very, very big on photojournalism. The site is very, very kind of photographically driven and oriented. The idea is to give people, nuance, context, meaty reads to get their minds around issues, and we range across, you know, business and economics, politics, art, culture, religion, science, technology, national affairs, obviously, although not based in Canberra, and we are basically aiming at giving people a reprieve, I suppose, from the kind of daily hard-driven dross of coverage of national and international affairs. Very, very heavy emphasis on global affairs as well. We've got 5 correspondents around the world, which we hope to increase at some point in the future. But the idea is that we're positioning what happens in this country in a kind of more global context.
And how do you see deadlines in this environment? Is it when the story is ready to publish, that's when it's published?
Absolutely. Yeah, we are certainly not tied to the 24/7, mayhem of a news cycle. We're in fact poised very, very, very strongly to escape that. We're not interested in the 24/7 news cycle. We take note of it. We watch it. We listen to it. We read it. We bounce off it. But we go away. We think a little bit more about what is happening in that cycle, and we write about it.
Now, I remember, like, way back when I worked on a local paper, we would sit around and we would almost play sort of fantasy newspaper. What would we do if one of us won the lottery and we could hire anyone we wanted and create the dream newspaper? And this is the thing. I can't think of anyone else probably who's ever been in this situation where you don't have commercial owners breathing down your neck and you could create something
as
you felt it had to be created.
Yep.
How did it happen?
Oh, well, I mean, how did it happen? It was born of a frustration that I felt with mainstream media. It was born of a frustration that we were being given kind of tabloid dross by and large and told that this is the news. This is current affairs. This is the way it's done. This is the way we will do it. I'd looked at the philanthropic model of ProPublica and loved it many, many, many years ago and dreamt of finding somebody who would be generous enough to fund it.
And that person was Graham Wood.
And that person was Graham Wood, who I subsequently met socially. And there was a meeting of minds, not on the first instance because we didn't actually discuss it when we first met, but subsequently I took the idea to him and said, what do you reckon about this? And he said, I love it. And, let's keep talking. So we kept talking. And then in the end, when he decided that this was something that he would like to philanthropically fund, he said, well, why don't you just go away and come up with a list of the people that you would like to hire and the people that you think will make this work, and let's go from there. And I did.
And a budget of about 3 to 4 million, something like that?
Yeah.
As a fellow not-for-profit publisher, how do you kind of persuade somebody to give you that kind of money with no prospect of a return immediately?
Well, it wasn't a matter of persuading him. I mean, I think that he had looked at what was out there as well and was rather dissatisfied with the thrust of mainstream media and felt like me that things could be done a bit differently and perhaps even better. And that people deserve to be given context and nuance, and that they deserve to have that across the board, that we that to be driven by the 24/7 news cycle wasn't to anybody's benefit. So if you do want to be, you know, if you want to catch up quickly on what's happening, well, there are lots of sites, mainstream sites that you can go to. But if you'd like a more considered read, a less breathless read of what really is going on in the world, then that's what we do. I mean, for example, today we this morning uploaded a fabulous piece by our correspondent in the Middle East, Jess Hill, and it is the most sensational and unique take on what happened this time last year in Cairo, which forced Hosni Mubarak to fall from power. Now, it's away from the breathless coverage. It's not talking about Facebook or Twitter. It's talking about some of the underlying rumblings in Egyptian society that we didn't know about, that we never heard about. And she's contextualized it in 2,000 words. And it's a beautiful read with beautiful pictures. And it will give you a very, very good idea of what really happened, which until I read it, I didn't know. So that's what we're about. Now, Graham didn't need much convincing that we're not getting that, because I think it's obvious to most people that we're not getting that. And, of course, with the impact of the internet on the business models of most mainstream media, as you all know, what's happening is that the first casualty is international bureaus. They either get chopped or they get pared back. Or they get paired back with correspondents who don't have the money to travel. So for me, the big thing was, well, we not only need the right people in the right places, we need a budget so that they can actually move around. So, you know, we've got a correspondent in Asia who, you know, I really have to put in a box sometimes and put a lid firmly on, because he's everywhere. He's been to Mongolia, he's been to China, he's been to Burma. He's on his way to Timor soon. Jess will travel widely in the Middle East. Our North America correspondent will travel widely. Our Latin American correspondent has already been, you know, Argentina, Brazil. I mean, he'll travel a lot. And a ditto in Europe. So you've got to, it's not just a matter of having enough money for a wage to have a person sitting in a bureau. They've got to be able to move. Otherwise, you may as well just rip and read off the wire services.
But presumably it's not a bottomless pit. So at some stage, that horrible word, you're going to have to monetize the site. What's the kind of strategy?
We don't have to monetize the site. We have no intention of monetizing the site.
So it is a bottomless pit.
Well, no, it's not a bottomless pit, but we have no, the site will remain free. We may well develop an app, and there may be some revenue streams that we can create around the app, but the site will remain free.
We ran a story on the launch, and while many readers in the comment stream were complimentary and, you know, said both it looked great and liked the content, one reader said, like Crikey, they'll start out high-minded, but as the seed money dries up, they'll have to find themselves a niche audience, as in going to the left, as Crikey has done.
Oh, so many cynics in the world. I'm surprised at the cynics, you know. It truly amazes me.
So Graham Wood's backed you for the first 5 years?
First 5 years, and certainly no indication that as people have unkindly put it, the tap gets turned off then. But I think the expectation is that in that 5 years, we will find ways to create revenue streams that may help us to be self-supporting. We will never be 100% self-supporting. There is no expectation nor any demand that we should be.
It's going more like the public radio system in the US, I guess, where do you think a time will come in the future where you'll be asking your readers to support you, for instance?
Not as donations. I don't think there's any incentive to do that in this country because of the current laws as they're set up. But, you know, there may be other methods, and they may revolve around the app. Mm. That's what I can see at this point. But to be absolutely honest with you, and I say this with a hand on heart, and people don't believe me when I say it, we haven't thought about it yet. We really haven't thought about it yet. We have been completely focused on getting the journalism exactly where we want it to be. And that's no easy feat when you're talking about the globe and when you're talking about the different personalities involved and when you're talking about multimedia.
Now, you mentioned, and certainly my feeling as a reader, is that there's much of a magazine feel about a lot of this. One of the things that many magazines also have is some sort of, you know, often separate from the journalism, an editorial view, an editorial direction. Is there a time when you think the Global Mail will stand for something?
We stand for honest journalism. We stand for honest, non-partisan, straight down the middle, facts journalism. What we don't stand for is commentary. We don't carry commentary.
And you never will carry commentary.
Well, one should never say never, but the commentary that we carry will always have a counterpart balancing it off. One, if it ever occurs, and two, we'll never have op-eds as such. There's no editorial line. We are following stories that our journalists put up as being interesting and in the public interest, and we cover them in as non-partisan a manner as we possibly can.
And your audience, firstly in Australia, how big do you think your potential audience is?
Huge. I don't know.
What sort of traffic are you getting so far?
Very good traffic. Really, really good traffic. I mean, it fluctuates between anywhere between 9,000 uniques a day to 37, I think, at the peak.
Okay.
So it's very,
so you
very
started
variable.
Fast then.
Yeah.
And do you have a kind of picture of a typical reader in mind yet, or?
No. In fact, I really want to stay away from being able to visualise, pigeonhole our readers. I'd like to think that we have got something for everybody. Now, when you go to our site and you scroll along the front page, you'll go, boring, marginal. Look at that. That's interesting. But that what's interesting for that person is not going to be interesting for the next person that comes along. Our aim is to provide something for everybody. So we do sport, when we've got it. We do, the art that we've done, the art coverage, for some could be a bit, too high art. But we'll do something at the other end of the spectrum, which is about theatre bloggers, which has been quite controversial, which is not high art.
Yes. That's been one of the most talked about pieces so far, actually.
It has been one of the most talked about pieces. That's really got the blogosphere, up in arms. That's fine. I mean, that's what we want. We want conversation.
Are you going to be able to do any writing yourself?
I hope so. I'd like to think that I can.
It's probably worth talking about your own journalistic background. Tell us about the route that you took.
I was destined to become a lawyer and started arts law at Sydney University, hated studying law, dropped out of the whole shebang, went off and got a cadetship with Fairfax Media, which then owned Channel 7. My cadetship was at Channel 7. I did half of my cadetship there, half of it at Fairfax. Stayed there for 4 years, went off to 2WS in its early days.
And you're obviously always attracted to the broadcast side of things.
Yeah, look, I think I'm a real show-off, I'm a performer. I like, I'm just, that's the kind of gal I am. I've just always liked performing. I then went off to 2WS and then to 2GB and then became 2GB in its Newsday period, but became quite disillusioned with 24/7 news as it was, and went off and travelled the world for a few years, came back and went to the ABC as one of its original Phantom Army members, where the ABC had thousands and thousands of employees, but half of us weren't really on the books. We were just kind of casual employees. And eventually I did become a permanent member of staff, and I was at Triple J. I went to News and Current Affairs, AMPM, The World Today, which was my homeland, really. I stayed there for a very, very long time, covered the Fitzgerald inquiry in Brisbane, got posted to Russia, where I was ABC correspondent to Russia for 4.5 years, came back. I've done Four Corners and I've done Late Line. And, of course, then I moved on and became the host of Media Watch on ABC TV.
Before we talk about Media Watch, you've also very modestly not mentioned that you had some recognition from the Walkleys along the way as well.
Oh, yes, there has been a little bit of recognition. So I have 5 Walkleys, one of which is Gold for Excellence in Journalism. And I have an Order of Australia, but apart from that.
So the false modesty is just finished.
Well, you asked the question, otherwise I wouldn't have even brought it up.
So just about Media Watch, did you have any ex-colleagues ringing you up and berating you for some of the coverage?
Your colleagues, there are certain editors who used to get very, very upset, and I'd have the ritual Tuesday morning phone call with the phone at a great distance from my ear. It's a tough gig, that one. It's a really tough gig. I think that personality-wise, in the end, I probably wasn't ideally set up for it. You know, I didn't enjoy the comeback a lot of the time. I fully recognise that if you dish it out, you got to cop it. Mm. I think that Media Watch is one of the most necessary programs in our democracy, frankly, and in the absence of anything, any regulatory bodies that have got grunt outside of the ABC to actually take it on, then it becomes even more critical. It'll be interesting to see what the media inquiry comes up with it when it brings its findings down. But in terms of the actual job, you know, like if it's a fun job, you can get all very hot under the collar and excited about certain indiscretions or misdemeanors by the media and all the rest of it, and then you kind of cop what comes back at you and you go, oh, God, that's not so much fun at all. I don't think it really affected my relationships with any of my colleagues that I know of. I think it's a very, very tough job to do for a working journalist who is connected to the media. Mm. I think Jonathan is fabulous, and he's so wry, and he has a sense of humour that I never had. But I'm sure he finds it tough too, because especially if you have a go at people inside your own organisation, i.e. the ABC, that's hard.
If the Global Mail was ever featured, would you be one of those angry editors on the phone on a Tuesday?
No, I would not be. I absolutely would not be.
Does the producer tell you to have a voice that's kind of like Jonathan and before you, I always noticed that they had that sort of cheeky tone to them, very dry tone. Did you adopt that as well?
Yeah, there is an expectation that you're a bit cheeky. Yeah. And I'm a very straight bat journo, you know, like I'm pretty straight up and down. So I struggled with that. And I think one of the criticisms of me when I did the job was that I had no sense of humour. And that's fine. I kind of wear that as a badge of honour. I don't take that as negative necessarily. But do producers ride you? No. I think it's a very delicate, it's a very different balance between producer and host on Media Watch than it is on any other show in television, because it very much has to be your view, your words, your view. It's not like you can't have a situation where a producer loads up the gun with the bullets and says, fire them.
I think they call that Today Tonight, don't they?
They do. That's called Today Tonight, and that's called The Current Affair. It's a very, very difficult balance to strike. But mostly it is struck, and I think to perfection at the moment, I have to say. I mean, I think Jonathan really does have a voice, and it's his voice, and you know it's his view, and it's very. It gives me enormous faith when I watch the show, which is really nice.
And one of the things that always strikes me is that there actually isn't that much analysis of the media on Australian television or Australian radio. Now we've seen the media report come back on the ABC recently.
Yeah,
but we're kind of underserved in that area, I think.
Yeah, well, it's hard to imagine. But when you look at the media landscape in Australia across the board, you got to start wondering what's going on. You know, you can't expect Fairfax, for example, to mount a television vodcast on the media. It's very difficult. There's the media section in The Australian, which can be quite good, has in years gone by been a bit self-serving, but it gets there sometimes, and it can be interesting and entertaining and informative, and that's all you want. But when you look at the media landscape across the board, where else would you expect it to happen? You know, it's so small, really.
Is it something that you would see the Global Mail getting into? Or is that too parochial thing to be looking at the Australian media?
I think it's way too parochial for us. Way, way, way too parochial for us. No, I don't see us getting into that at all. Yeah.
Next, the Fairfax Data Dump.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
If you heard last week's Mumbrella Cast, you'll be aware that the latest Audit Bureau of Circulations figures saw a drop in print circulation for most newspapers and several magazines. Fairfax Media, meanwhile, looked to seize back the agenda by releasing data on its audiences across all digital platforms. Tim, the SMH had the biggest fall, down 12% on last year. Are the digital audiences growing fast enough?
Yeah, this obviously is the crunch question. So the issue is, you know, for every copy of the paper that you're not selling anymore is somebody reading you online. But the sort of secondary issue to that as well is the amount of advertising dollars you get against each 1,000 people reading you in print is a lot smaller when you come to online. So the question is, you know, can the revenue you're bringing in from digital ever catch up? So what we're seeing are, you know, a number of different, almost experiments, people trying different things, whether it's iPad editions, whether it's just straightforward advertising, either on sites or on tablets or, you know, whatever mobile device you're reading on, whether it's those PDF-like digital editions or other types of in-app sales. But the short answer is, at the moment, there's definitely a shortfall. You know, the print sales are falling away faster than people seem to be turning to those same mastheads in digital, and certainly the revenue is going away. So at the moment, it feels like there's a gap to me.
Tim, you wrote a very detailed analysis of this stuff on Mumbrella this week. Do you see a point where that crossover might happen? Is it, you know, are we still years away, or...?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real crunch, isn't it? I mean, I just think we'll end up seeing some of these big organisations that were strong in print as smaller organisations. Mm. You know, so... yes, there will probably always be a Fairfax and probably always be a News Limited. But, you know, I'm not sure that they'll be as dominant in the future. You know, they'll be one of more players in a market where there aren't so many barriers to entry. You know, in traditional media, in TV and radio, you need spectrum, you need licenses. In print, you don't need that, but what you do need is a giant printing press and the means of distribution. So there's enormous cost behind that. But digital just brings in more players.
And does Fairfax's transparency put more pressure on their rivals to do the same, do you
think?
Yeah,
I think it probably does, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, the fact that Fairfax has released all this data, News Limited have been making just as much noise about their apps, about their paywall, all of these things. Slightly different strategy. Obviously, most of what Fairfax has done to this point has been free. You know, they try to make some money with in-app stuff, but mostly it's free. Whereas News has been doing the free trial, but is about to move, well, it has now moved to the kind of the paying element for the people who had their first 3 months for the Australians' paywall. So the argument they would probably make would be, well, we're in this transition phase at the moment, the numbers wouldn't mean very much. But, you know, they've had sponsors against some of this stuff, they've had advertisers against some of this stuff. So those people will want information, the market will want information if they're going to support it. The fact that their biggest rival does release it does suggest that, you know, News Limited is probably going to have to start sharing some numbers at some point.
Do you think, it's probably a slight side issue, but the whole kind of thing about transparency and about being audited and all that stuff is that because people kind of try and spin the numbers, that almost everybody gets discredited because no one really believes what people say. I mean, you know, is that an issue, do you think?
Particularly when you're outside of audit, yeah. And, you know, this is one of the things with the Fairfax numbers is a lot of it, you know, just it's metrics which can't be audited or which isn't audited yet. So clearly they have to make their own publisher's declaration. But yeah, you know, you have the problem and you have the frustration that people are out claiming numbers to the market that don't match what's audited or just don't get themselves audited. So you end up with digital being this kind of, it should be this, you know, the most transparent, the most honest medium, yet sometimes it's still kind of the Wild West.
Which begs the question, is does auditing in itself have value as a publisher?
Yeah, I would argue it is. It's a trust thing, isn't it? You know, you can probably trust numbers better when they're audited, and you're also limited in the kind of claims you can make as a publisher if you're audited as well, because the audit body can come down on you if they catch you saying things that aren't true. So, but what you need is the market to be asking hard questions.
Yes. Yeah.
Because if they're not getting intelligent questions from advertisers, from media agencies about, are you audited? Why aren't you audited? It doesn't cost that much. What are you hiding? Then there isn't the incentive to pay to be audited.
Yeah, I guess that's probably part of my frustration with it is that, you know, you do the right thing, you stand by your numbers, but are the advertisers actually intelligent enough to ask the right questions.
It's a long it's an educational thing, isn't it? You know, and it's just asking the question, asking it in an aggressive way.
What happens if you don't? If you are caught fudging your numbers or something like that, you said the auditing bureau will come down on you. What happens? What's the punishment?
The ultimate thing, if you were caught fiddling audited numbers, is that you lose your audit, you get kicked out. And of course, it's the credibility you lose in the market. Even when you're what happens on a semi-regular basis is somebody makes a claim that they actually can't sustain, and the one of the audit bureaus looks into it and actually makes them retract that claim. And of course, all of their rivals can make great hay with that because it's really embarrassing having to restate your numbers or whatever it is. So it's the shame factor of being caught to do it, but it relies on being audited meaning something in the first place to be scared of not being audited.
My just as an aside, my personal experience has been that the audit bureau isn't as aggressive as it might be in getting people to retract false claims. They might say don't do it again, but not don't tell all of the people you've misled that you misled them.
Yeah, and I suppose the issue is there's this diplomacy thing as well, isn't it? You know, they have a relatively small number of members, and those members are often the transgressors as well when it happens. So I'm sure there are certain things that deals that get done behind closed doors at times. I'm sure.
Next, ACP for sale.
The Australian Financial Review this week reported that Seven West Media was in talks to buy ACP magazines from its debt-laden owner, Nine Entertainment Co. Now, Seven West already owns Pacific Mags, which effectively means that we could see ACP being ended up in the hands of their rival PacMags. Now, competition law prevents sort of big deals happening in what might be defined as significant markets, where it would be a sort of large significant market that could be distorted with a big deal. Martin, do you think that magazines still deserve to be counted as a significant market?
I think that's a very cheeky question, and probably one for the ACCC rather than myself. But I guess what will happen if that deal was to go through is that there will be lots of noise about synergies and right-sizing our business and blah, 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 which will all be code for closing magazines where you've got two operating in a similar space. And what you'll end up with is obviously it's not a case of 1 + 1 is going to equal 2. It's going to be 1 + 1 might equal 1.25 or something, in which case, arguably, it's not such a big issue as it might once have been. But clearly it does, I'm not a big fan of, media being controlled by fewer players rather than more players. So ACCC will decide, I guess.
Tim, would they, if they were to purchase ACP, would they cull a large selection of the magazines where crossovers existed, say, Scratching New Idea because Women's Day has a better circulation?
The thing is, I think that's probably the sort of thing that the ACCC doesn't like, so there might be some undertakings made. And, of course, the other thing is, it's worth stressing, we're a long, long way from there being a deal. There are just some early conversations. What I wonder is actually what will happen would be whether there's actually more than one transaction, that PacMags ends up with a few things which are kind of complementary, and others maybe get, go another direction. Matt Hanbury's already shown an interest in buying, certainly in trying to raise the funds to buy ACP himself, which he didn't appear to succeed at. But, he clearly is a good magazine guy, ran Murdoch magazines very well, very successfully, knows what he's doing. So I think we could maybe see him come in and pick up some of the assets. So I wonder, even if it does happen, whether actually, we see another player almost enter the market.
And what would happen to the rest of them? I mean, we've had both our former employer, Reed Business Information, was up for sale, and a deal didn't get done in the end. But there was some cherry picking of some of the kind of, more profitable titles. But it sort of leaves a bit of a basket case behind, doesn't it?
Yeah, in the end, I'm sure there'll presumably be a sale. At some point, there will no longer be an ACP magazines in Park Street at the headquarters. That'll become an investment bank or something, I suppose.
What will happen of the show?
Well, yes, the marvellous show, Park Street. Yeah, sadly, they never did get a second series. I can't possibly imagine why.
And what will it mean for agencies and the buying power of ad space?
That comes down to the competition thing. You know, I think probably they would have been a bit more scared a few years ago. You know, the fact now is that magazines are having to fight harder than ever to get dollars from the advertisers. So I suspect that, yes, it would be, let's work on the assumption that PacMags becomes the single dominant player. Then certainly it gives them a far more powerful tool in that magazine market. But they've still got to persuade their advertisers that it's magazines they want to be in the first place.
Next, The Week in TV.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Sunday saw the return of the ratings season. Nine won the night thanks to the cricket, but it's been Seven's game ever since. My Kitchen Rules has stayed consistently strong, while the heavily promoted show Revenge, also for Seven, scored the network 2 million viewers.
Now, Colin, Revenge has been the big hit so far, as you say. What did you think of it?
It was heavily promoted. I think they started doing promotions at the end of last year's X Factor. So, and this has been running through, and you said that you can't hear that Coldplay song without thinking of the Revenge clip.
Yes, yeah, it's just been constant. Any movie you've seen in the last 2 months at the cinema, the trailer's been running.
Mm.
Do you know how much I love you, Amanda?
Infinity.
When I was a little girl, my father died an innocent man. Betrayed by the woman he loved. But when everything you love has been stolen from you, someone has to pay.
Welcome to the Hamptons.
You won't find a better address than this. I'll take it.
My money's new to the Hamptons.
Well, now that you've moved in next door, I suppose we'll be seeing a lot of you this summer.
I think it's a ABC, the ABC in the US, I think it's one of their shows. To me, it feels a bit like Gossip Girl with knives. It's aimed at the 16 to 39 market. But, I mean, it's certainly, all the promos really, really worked for Seven. But in saying that, My Kitchen Rules came out. We record this on a Thursday, so last night on Wednesday did 1.9 million itself, so which is the best numbers that it's done this year.
Now, this week also saw the return of Seven's Pack to the Rafters, double episode, rating 1.5 million, which is actually about 25% down on last year, so it's hard to work out whether that one is good news or bad news. You know, Seven would have been happy that it rated well, won its time slots. Second in the night. But behind another Seven show, though, in My Kitchen Rules.
Had its day, maybe?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, we'll know in a few weeks' time, because if you know, the premiere always tends to do a bit better. So if the numbers are down for the rest of the series by 25%, then people start, you know, start worrying a bit. But, you know, there's still strong numbers, and then, you know, there's not really, with the possible exception of Underbelly, another Australian drama to touch it for those numbers.
No, it's a shame. I mean, I've never really got into the show, but it's a shame that an Australian drama, which was doing so strongly, has sort of slipped off a bit to let the reality fests in.
Yes. Yeah, no, it kind of... And that's always the thing, you know, drama comes expensive. And comedy comes cheap. Speaking of which, Tuesday was the premiere of Nine's new comedy, Two Broke Girls, at 8 p.m. in the 8 p.m. slot, which inherited some of Big Bang Theory's 1.13 million, but still couldn't break the million mark itself, which would have been disappointing because that was fairly heavily promoted.
Excuse me. Waitress. Dude.
Hi, what can I get you?
We need some.
Is that annoying? Is that obnoxious and rude? Would you find it distracting if someone did that to you while you were working? Oh, you don't have a job, sorry.
Damn, dude, she burned you.
Oh.
No.
Hipster. No. Do not think we're on the same team. We have nothing in common. I wear knit hats when it's cold out. You wear knit hats because of Coldplay. And finally, you think this is the sound that gets you service. I think this is the sound that dries up my vagina.
We need horseradish.
Please.
That, ladies, is how you treat a waitress.
You watched it, Tim. Thoughts?
It wasn't for me, but I'm not sure it ever was for me. I was watching it, I was thinking, hang on, I've seen some of these jokes on other sitcoms in the past. You know, there was even the opening the door at the apartment saying, oh my God, you've been robbed. No, I'm just untidy.
Gang. Oh, dear. It's like one of mine.
but I was watching what people were saying on Twitter, and clearly if you're unable to spell, and based on that, an ill-educated Twitter user who seems to be about 22 and a girl, then this might be your show.
Who are you following?
Well, I mean, that this is the beauty of the hashtag. You can see what Australia is saying. So those who are using the hashtag Two Broke Girls, there were some people liked it.
I was proofreading the latest issue of Encore magazine in your shops from March yesterday, and one of the columnists suggested that maybe Australia just doesn't do sitcoms well and should leave it to the Brits and the Americans. What do you think, fellow Brits?
I think that would be a very, very unpopular view with our audience.
However, tell us about Yes, Prime Minister.
Hilarious.
No, that's also one of the comments, or we're receiving, you know, numerous comments in Encore Online about why can't Australians do comedy, or why can't the networks give anyone other than the guys from The Chaser and the guys from Working Dog a chance, because, you know, there's not a lot else out there. You know, obviously Zapruder's light entertainment is funny at times, but yeah, it's a shame. Gone of the 90s when we had Full Frontal and Fast Forward and great sketch comedy.
That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Monica.
Thank you.
To Martin.
Pleasure.
And Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle pip. Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week...
Is the Global Mail a new model for journalism?
Fairfax's big dump.
I hadn't noticed that. sorry, let's make it big data dump.
Okay.
Just from that line.
Okay.
Oh, you're no fun anymore.
Was it you who changed?
No.